He was the second to follow this course. 4 months before, another such vessel, called the Oretto, had accomplished this same metamorphosis from merchantman to raider, and already she was at work as the Confederate cruiser Florida, her mission being the high seas destruction of federal commerce. Commanded by Captain J.N. Maffitt, she was to take 34 prizes before her career ended 2 years later. But it was the Alabama which did most in this direction, provoking a rise of more than 900% in U.S. Marine insurance and the transfer of over 700 Union merchant ships to British registry. Also, she gave the South another hero in the person of her skipper, Captain Raphael Semmes, a 53-year-old Maryland-born Alabamian, known to his crew, mostly foreigners off the docks of Liverpool, whom he referred to as a precious set of rascals, as Old Beeswax because of the care he gave his long black needle-sharp mustachios. He had had considerable experience at this kind of work as captain of the Sumter, the first of the rebel raiders, a commander in the Old Navy, ensconced in comfort as head of the Lighthouse Board in Washington. He had gone south in February of the year before and offered his services to the new government in Montgomery. Secretary Mallory sent him back north on a purchasing expedition, and when he returned, informed him that the Confederacy had acquired a small propeller steamer of 500 tons. She was tied up to a New Orleans wharf, he added, awaiting a chance to slip past the federal blockaders in order to undertake disruption of the sea lanes. "Mr. Secretary, give me that ship," Semmes said. "I think I can make her answer the purpose." Mallory gave him what he asked for, along with general instructions. "On reaching the high seas, you are to do the enemy's commerce the greatest injury in the shortest time. Choose your own cruising grounds, burn, sink, and destroy, and be guided always by the laws of the nations and of humanity." That was in mid-April. Semmes made his escape from the mouth of the Mississippi on the last day of June and took his first prize 4 days later. In the course of the next 7 months, he took 17 more barks, brigantines, and schooners, which he captured, burned, or ransomed in the Gulf and the Atlantic. Bottled up in Gibraltar from January to April, he sold the Sumter, discharged her crew, and took passage for Southampton. Late in May, he left for Nassau, intending to board a blockade runner there and get back home. If the Navy had another ship for him, he would take it. If not, he planned to transfer to the Army. What awaited him at Nassau, however, were instructions for him to return to England and assume secret command of the 290 Alabama. He took over officially off the island of Terceira on August 24th, when the cruiser was formally commissioned. Having named the Florida for his native state, Mallory had named this second English-built warship for the state in which the Confederacy itself was born. Bark-rigged, with handsome rakish lines, she was 235 feet in length, 32 feet in the beam, and displaced 1,000 tons. Her armament was 8 guns, 3 32-pounders on each broadside and 2 pivot guns on the center line, one a 7-inch rifle and the other an 8-inch smoothbore. 2 300-horsepower engines gave her a speed of 10 knots on steam alone, but with the help of her sails and a friendly wind, she could make nearly 15, which approached top speed for seagoing ships of the time. When traveling under sail alone, as she often would to conserve fuel, 275 tons of coal in her bunkers were barely enough for 18 days of steaming at moderate speed. Her two-bladed screw could be triced up into a propeller well, clear of the water, and thus afford no drag. To her crew of 24 gray-clad officers and 120 men, she was a beautiful thing on her commissioning day. Her brass was bright, her decks were clean and fragrant, her taunt-hauled rigging gleamed with newness. To Semmes himself, she seemed a bride with the orange wreath about her brows, ready to be led to the altar. Led instead on her shakedown cruise, she took her first prize 12 days later, the whaling schooner Okmulgee of Edgartown, Massachusetts, caught with her sails furled, a dead whale moored alongside, and her crew busy stripping blubber. Brimming with sperm oil, she was valued at $50,000 and made a spectacular conflagration. Semmes took her crew aboard the Alabama, released them next day within sight of land, their whaleboats loaded to the gunwales with all they had managed to salvage before their ship was burned, and continued his search for other prizes. Before September was over, he had taken 10. In October, he took 11. By early December, he had raised the total to 26, removing from each its chronometer, which he added to the others in his collection, including the 18 transferred from the Sumter, and wound them regularly by way of counting tally. By now, his fame or infamy was established. To Northerners, despite the invariable courtesy and consideration he showed his temporary captives, he was a bloodthirsty pirate, an Algerine corsair. To his crew, often vexed that he allowed no individual pillage, he seemed no such thing. In time, despite the strangeness of his manner, including the fact that he seldom spoke to anyone, and the tightness of his discipline, "Democracies may do very well for the land," he once explained, "but monarchies, and pretty absolute monarchies at that, are the only successful governments for the sea." The officers and men of the Alabama paid him not only his due of absolute obedience, but also the homage of genuine affection. It was not a question of patriotism. Few of the officers, and none of the men, were even Americans, let alone Southerners. They were mostly English, Welsh, and Irish, with a scattering of French, Italian, Spanish, and Russian sailors among them. Their allegiance was to him and the Alabama. They liked to watch his gray eyes glint blue when he sighted a prize off on the bulge of the horizon, and they approved of his Catholic devoutness, knowing that he began and ended each day on his knees before the little shrine in his cabin. Blurred by distance, to his countrymen he was something less, and also something more. He was, in fact, a member of that growing band of heroes who, as the Alabama began her career with the burning of the Okmulgee, seemed about to make good the impossible claims and threats with which the fire-eaters had prefaced the reality of war. Lee was crossing the Potomac, Bragg was on the march for Kentucky, and Kirby Smith was in Lexington. Semmes was therefore proof that the South could take the offensive at sea as well as on land. Moreover, though those others had been turned back, he kept on, taking prizes which he burned or sank or, if it was impractical to remove their crews and passengers to safety, released on ransom bond. This last, sometimes resorted to when the cruiser was crowded to capacity with captives, was an agreement between Semmes and the master of the vessel, whereby the latter pledged the owner to pay a stipulated amount under the President of the Confederate States of America within 30 days after the conclusion of the present war. It was, in effect, a bet that the South would win, and as such it did much to increase the pride of Southerners in their lawyer raider, who thus expressed before the eyes of the world their confidence in the outcome of their struggle for independence. Another cause for pride in Southern arms derived from an older source, in fact from the oldest source of all. Though Lee and Bragg and Kirby Smith had returned from their expeditions, disappointing the hopes that had gone with them, Beauregard, the original hero back on the scene of his original triumph, had not been long in justifying the cheers with which Charlestonians had greeted his return. October 22nd, 5 weeks after his arrival, a federal attempt to cut the Charleston and Savannah Railroad at Pocataligo, midway between those two coastal cities, was foiled when 4,500 bluecoats under Ormsby Mitchell, within 8 days of sudden death from yellow fever, were thrown back to their landing boats by half as many rebels. Casualties were 340 and 163, respectively. "Railroad uninjured," Beauregard wired Richmond. Abolitionists left dead and wounded on the field, our cavalry in hot pursuit. Old Borry was himself again. Slight though they were, by comparison, that is, with the resounding double failure, east and west, of the Confederacy's first concerted attempt at all-out invasion, these late fall and early winter successes, afloat and ashore, did much to sustain or restore the confidence of the Southern people. Besides, they could tell themselves, the strategic offensive was for extra, a device to be employed from time to time, not so much with the intention of keeping the graybacks north of the Potomac or the Cumberland, but rather of establishing an interlude for harvesting the crops in forward areas, and thereby gaining a breathing spell in which the natives could enjoy at least a temporary freedom from the oppressive presence of the bluecoats. It was the strategic defensive that counted. It was this they had been pledged to by their president when he told the world, "All we ask is to be let alone." And in this, considering the odds, they had been singularly successful, especially in the east, where three full-scale attempts at invasion had been smashed and a fourth halted dead in its tracks when its commander was retired for the second time. In the west, too, there was occasion for rejoicing and self-congratulation. After a long season of reverses, a series of collapses under inexorable pressure, the front of the principal sector had been advanced 150 miles, from North Mississippi to Middle Tennessee. On the Mississippi itself, the upper and lower Union fleets, conjoined triumphantly above Vicksburg, had been sundered and sent their separate ways by a single homemade ironclad, while across the river in Arkansas, an army created seemingly out of thin air was on the march for Missouri. All this was much, enough indeed to satisfy the hungriest of seekers after glory, and the thought of such accomplishments went far toward offsetting the pain of earlier reverses. However, to ease the ache was not to cure the ailment. The effect of the worst of the early reverses still remained. Norfolk was lost, and with it the one hope for the home construction of a Confederate deep-sea navy. So, continuing clockwise down and around the coast, were the North Carolina Sounds, Port Royal and Fort Pulaski, Brunswick and Fernandina, Jacksonville and St. Augustine, Apalachicola and Pensacola, Biloxi and Pass Christian, Ship Island and Galveston. All these were tangent hits, mainly painful to Southern pride and to Southern pocketbooks, augmenting as they did the effectiveness of the federal blockade. But there were others that hurt worse, being vital. Nashville was gone, and so were New Orleans and Memphis. At the time of their loss, people had told themselves that these cities would be recovered, along with the outlying points around the littoral, once the pressure in front had been relieved. Apparently, though, that had been mere whistling in the dark. Four times now the pressure had eased up. After First Manassas, Wilson's Creek, the evacuation of Corinth, and Second Manassas. Yet in all four instances, the Southern commanders who tried to take advantage of the respite gained were either repulsed when they moved forward or else they fell back eventually of their own accord. In fact, of the four advances which had followed these events, Johnston's into northern Virginia, Price's into northern Missouri, Bragg's into Kentucky, and Lee's into Maryland, all but Bragg's had wound up south of the point from which they had been launched. It was small wonder then at this stage that Southerners discounted the advantages of the offensive, considering how little had been gained from three of these four attempts, and how much had been lost by two others, Shiloh and Baton Rouge, even though both were generally referred to as tactical victories and were prime sources of the glory which so far had been the South's chief gain from 20 months of war. Yet glory was a flimsy diet at best, containing far more of what Southerners called suption than of substance. No one realized this better than Davis, who had had an overplus of glory down the years, and who, familiar with it as he was, knew how little real sustenance it afforded. Moreover, as a professional soldier, in touch with every department of the army he commanded, he not only recognized the odds his country faced in its struggle for independence, he saw that they were lengthening with every passing month as the North's tremendous potential was converted into actuality. In that sense, not only was time against him, even success was against him, for each northern reverse brought on a quickening of the tempo of conversion. And yet, paradoxically, it was time for which he was fighting. Time alone could bring into being in the North the discouragement, the sheer boredom even, which was the South's chief hope for victory, if foreign intervention failed to materialize, as now seemed likely. Meanwhile, there were the odds to face, and Davis faced them. He did not know what future combinations were being designed for the Confederacy's destruction, but he knew they would be heavy when they came. Here in the East, Lee could be trusted to cope with whatever forces the Union High Command might conceive to be his match. Likewise, in the Trans-Mississippi, though the outlook was far from bright, Hindman's improvisations, Magruder's theatrical ingenuity, and Taylor's hard-working common sense gave promise of achieving at least a balance. It was in the West, that region between the Blue Ridge and the Mississippi, where Federal troops had scored their most substantial gains, that the Commander-in-Chief perceived the gravest danger. Whether Johnston would prove himself another Lee, coordinating the efforts of his separate armies in order to frustrate those of his opponents, remained to be seen. So far, though, the signs had not been promising. A gloom had descended on the Gamecock general, who seemed more intent on acquiring troops from outside his department than on setting up a system for the mutual support of those within it. Also, there were continuing rumors of dissension in Bragg's army. All this seemed to indicate a need for intervention, or at any rate a personal inspection, by the man who had designed the new command arrangement in the first place. Davis had not been more than a day's trip from Richmond since his arrival in late May of the year before, but now in early December he packed his bags for the long ride to Chattanooga and Vicksburg. Thus he would not only see at first hand the nature of the problems in the region which was his home, he would also provide an answer to those critics who complained that the authorities in the capital had no concern for what went on outside the Eastern Theater. One drawback this had, and for Davis it was of the kind that could never be taken lightly. The trip would mean another separation from the family he had missed so much while they were in North Carolina for the summer. "I go into the nursery as a bird may go to the robbed nest," he had written his wife in June, and he added, "My ease, my health, my property, my life I can give to the cause of my country. The heroism which could lay my wife and children on any sacrificial altar is not mine." For all the busyness and anxiety of those days and nights when McClellan's campfires rimmed the east, the White House had seemed to him an empty thing without the laughter of his sons and the companionship of the woman who was his only confidant. "I have no attraction to draw me from my office now," he wrote, "and home is no longer a locality." In September they returned, to his great joy. Mrs. Davis found him thinner, the failing eye gone blinder and the lines grooved deeper in his face. "I have no political wish beyond the success of our cause," he had written her. "No personal desire but to be relieved from further connection with office. Opposition in any form can only disturb me inasmuch as it may endanger the public welfare." But the critics were in full bay again as the fall wore on, including his own vice president, and it was clear to his wife that he was indeed disturbed. At the outset, back in Montgomery, he had spoken of a people united in heart, where one purpose of high resolve animates and actuates the whole. Lately, this evaluation had been considerably modified. "Revolutions develop the high qualities of the good and the great," he wrote, "but they cannot change the nature of the vicious and the selfish." He had this to live with now, this change of outlook, this reassessment of his fellow man, with the result that he was more troubled by neuralgia than ever and more in need of his wife's ministrations. Present dangers, front and rear, had given even pretended dangers an increased reality, and it added to his sympathy for all sufferers everywhere, including those in the world of light fiction. One day, for example, when he was confined to bed with a cloth over his eyes and forehead, she tried to relieve the monotony by reading to him from a current melodramatic novel. He was so quiet she thought he was asleep, but she did not stop for fear of waking him. As she approached the climax of the story wherein the bad man had the heroine in his power and was advancing on her for some evil purpose, Mrs. Davis heard a voice exclaim, "The infernal villain!" and looking around, saw her husband sitting bolt upright in bed, with both fists clenched. Whether this was the result of too much imagination or too little was a question which would linger down the years. But some there were already who believed that nothing except short-sightedness could hide the eventual outcome of the long odds struggle from anyone willing to examine the facts disclosed in the course of this opening half of the second year of conflict. Senator Herschel V. Johnson of Georgia, Stephen Douglas's running mate in the 1860 election and now a prominent member of the Confederate Congress, replied to a question from a friend in late October, "You ask me if I have confidence in the success of the Southern Confederacy. I pray for success, but I do not expect success. The enemy in due time will penetrate the heart of the Confederacy, and the hearts of our people will quake, and their spirits will yield to the force of overpowering numbers." He saw the outcome clearly, and he found it unavoidable. The enemy is superior to us in everything but courage, and therefore it is quite certain, if the war is to go on until exhaustion overtake the one side or the other side, that we shall be the first to be exhausted. Whether or not this would be the case, whether the South, fighting for such anachronisms as slavery and self-government, could sustain the conflict past the breaking point of Northern determination, Davis did not know. Much of what his dead friend Albert Sidney Johnston had called the fair, broad, abounding land had already fallen to the invaders. How much more would fall, or whether the rising blue tide could be stemmed, was dependent on the gray-clad men in the Southern ranks and the spirit with which they followed their star-crossed battle flags. Just now that spirit was at its height. "We may be annihilated," the first soldier of them all had said, "but we cannot be conquered." Davis thought so too, though he offered no easy solutions in support of his belief. Now, in December, as he prepared to leave on his journey to the troubled Western Theater, he could only repeat what he had told his wife in May. "I cultivate hope and patience, and trust to the blunders of our enemy and the gallantry of our troops for ultimate success." 3. Our cause, we love to think, is specially God's, the Connecticut theologian Horace Bushnell told his Hartford congregation. "Every drumbeat is a hymn, the cannon thunder God, the electric silence darting victory along the wires is the inaudible greeting of God's favoring word." His belief that the evil was all on the other side was based on a conviction that war had come because willful men beyond the Potomac had laid rude hands on the tabernacle of the law. "Law is grounded in right, and right is a moral idea, at whose summit stands God as the everlasting vindicator." Thus the logic came full circle. We associate God and religion with all we are fighting for, and we are not satisfied with any mere human atheistic way of speaking as to means or measures or battles or victories or the great deeds to win them. The assertion that this was a holy war, in fact a crusade, was by no means restricted to those who made it from a pulpit. Vindicating the majesty of an insulted government by extirpating all rebels and fumigating their nests with the brimstone of unmitigated hell, I conceive to be the holy purpose of our further efforts, a Massachusetts colonel wrote home to his governor from Beaufort, South Carolina, and being within 50 airline miles of the very birthplace of rebellion, he added, I hope I shall do something in the great fumigation before the sulfur gives out. Just what it was that he proposed to do with regard to those he called our southern brethren, he had announced while waiting at Annapolis for the ship that brought him down the coast. Do we fight them to avenge insult? No, the thing we seek is permanent dominion. And what instance is there of permanent dominion without changing, revolutionizing, absorbing the institutions, life, and manners of the conquered peoples? They think we mean to take their slaves. Bah! We must take their ports, their mines, their water power, the very soil they plow, and develop them by the hands of our artisan armies. We are to be a regenerating colonizing power, or we are to be whipped. Schoolmasters with howitzers must instruct our southern brethren that they are a set of damned fools in everything that relates to modern civilization. This army must not come back. Settlement, migration must put the seal on battle, or we gain nothing. Tecumseh Sherman, biding his time in Memphis, where sharp-eyed men with itchy palms had followed in the wake of advancing armies, much as refuse along the right-of-way was sucked into the rearward vacuum of a speeding locomotive, threw the blame in another direction. "The cause of the war is not alone in the nigger," he told his wife, "but in the mercenary spirit of our countrymen. Cincinnati furnishes more contraband goods than Charleston, and has done more to prolong the war than the state of South Carolina. Not a merchant there but would sell salt, bacon, powder, and lead if they can make money by it." So the volatile red-haired general wrote, finding his former nerve-jangled opinion reinforced by the difficulties since encountered all along the fighting front. "If the North designed to conquer the South, we must begin at Kentucky and reconquer the country from there as we did from the Indians. It was this conviction then, as plainly as now, that made men think I was insane. A good many flatterers now want to make me a prophet." Prophet or not, he could speak like one in an early October letter to his senator brother. "I rather think you now agree with me that this is no common war. You must now see that I was right in not seeking prominence at the outstart. I knew and know yet that the northern people have to unlearn all their experience of the past 30 years and be born again before they will see the truth." None of it had been easy thus far, nor was it going to be any easier in the future. The prow of the ship might pierce the wave, yet once it was clear of the vessel's stern, the wave was whole again. "Though our armies pass across and through the land, the war closes in behind and leaves the same enemy behind. I don't see the end," he concluded, "or the beginning of the end, but suppose we must prevail and persist or perish." He saw only one solution, an outgrowth of the statement to his wife that the federal armies would have to reconquer the country as we did from the Indians. What was required from here on was harshness. "We cannot change the hearts of the people of the South," he told his friend and superior, Grant. "But we can make war so terrible that they will realize the fact that, however brave and gallant and devoted to their country, still they are mortal and should exhaust all peaceful remedies before they fly to war." For Lincoln, too, it was a question of prevail and persist or perish. For him, moreover, there was the added problem of coordinating the efforts, and, if possible, reconciling the views, of these three random extremists, together with those of more than 20 million other individuals along and behind the firing line. The best way to accomplish this, he knew, was to unite them under a leader whose competence they believed in and whose views they would adopt as their own, even when those views came into conflict with their preconceptions. In facing this task, he started not from scratch, but from somewhere well behind it. "The president is an honest, plain, shrewd magistrate," Harper's Weekly had told its readers a year ago this December. "He is not a brilliant orator. He is not a great leader. He views his office as strictly an executive one and wishes to cast responsibility as much as possible upon Congress." This tallied with the view of Attorney General Edward Bates, who wrote in his diary after attending a cabinet meeting held at about the same time, "The President is an excellent man, and in the main wise, but he lacks will and purpose, and I greatly fear he has not the power to command." Since then, a good many high-placed men, including Bates, who had seen Cameron banished and the bricks applied to Stanton, had had occasion to learn better, though not all. The poet Whittier, for example, saw victory only through a haze of ifs. "The worst of the ifs is the one concerning Lincoln," he privately declared. "I am much afraid that a domestic cat will not answer when one wants a Bengal tiger." His fellow poet William Cullen Bryant agreed. "The people, after their gigantic preparation and sacrifice, have looked for an adequate return and looked in vain," he editorialized in the New York Evening Post. "They have seen armies unused in the field perish in pestilential swamps. They have seen their money wasted in long winter encampments or frittered away on fruitless expeditions along the coast. They have seen a huge debt roll up, yet no prospect of greater military results." Wendell Phillips, bitter as ever, continued to aim an indignant finger at the White House. "The North has poured out its blood and money like water. It has leveled every fence of constitutional privilege," he declaimed. "And Abraham Lincoln sits today a more unlimited despot than the world knows this side of China. What does he render for this unbounded confidence? Show us something," he cried in the direction he was pointing, "or I tell you that within 2 years the indignant reaction of the people will hurl the cabinet in contempt from their seats." Confronted with such judgments handed down by public men who thus came between him and his purpose of unification, Lincoln kept his temper and his poise. If he failed in his attempts to win these critics over by means of personal discussion, face to face in his office, "What is he wrathy about? Why does he not come down here and have a talk with me?" he went beyond them to the people. Sometimes he did so in cold print, as in the case of his answer to Greeley's prayer of 20 millions. But generally he proceeded in a manner that was strangely intimate in its effect, acting on a larger stage the role he had played in Illinois. In Washington, as in Springfield, he received all comers, and for the most part he received them with a sympathy which, by their own admission, equaled or exceeded their deserving. He shook their hands at frequent public receptions held in the White House, which was his home and yet belonged to them. He attended the theater, a form of relaxation which kept him still within their view. He drove or rode almost daily through the spoke-like streets of the hive-dense city, returning the looks and salutes of men and women and children along the way. Thousands touched him, heard him, saw him at close range, and scarcely one in all those thousands ever forgot the sight of that tall figure, made still taller by the stovepipe hat and the homely drape of the shawl across the shoulders. Never forgotten because it was unforgettable, the impression remained, incredible and enduring, imperishable in its singularity, and finally dear. Millions who did not see him saw his picture, and this too was a part of the effect. Widely broadcast as it was, the result of recent developments in photography and the process of reproduction, his had become within 2 crowded years the most familiar face in American history. At first sight, this might appear to be a liability. The Paris correspondent of the New York Times, for example, sent home a paragraph titled "Lincoln's Fizz in Europe," in which he suggested the wisdom of declaring an embargo on portraits of the president, at least so far as France was concerned. The person represented in these pictures looks so much like a man condemned to the gallows that large numbers of them have been imposed on the people here by the shopkeepers as Dumollard, the famous murderer of servant girls, lately guillotined near Lyon. Such a face is enough to ruin the best of causes. People read the name inscribed under it with astonishment, or rather bewilderment, for the thing appears more like a hoax than a reality. Yet here, too, something worked in his favor. It was as if, having so far overshot the mark of ugliness, The face was not to be judged by ordinary standards. You saw it not so much for what it was as for what it held. Suffering was in it. So were understanding, kindliness, and determination. None of us to our dying day can forget that countenance, an infantryman wrote on the occasion of a presidential visit to the army. Concentrated in that one great, strong, yet tender face, the agony of the life-and-death struggle of the hour was revealed as we had never seen it before. With a new understanding, we knew why we were soldiers. Herein lay the explanation for much that otherwise could not be understood. By Jefferson Davis, for one, who had expressed contemptuous astonishment at seeing his late compatriots submit to what he called the mere edict of a despot. They did not see their submission in that light. "I know very well that many others might do better than I can," Lincoln had told the cabinet in September. "And if I were satisfied that the public confidence was more fully possessed by any one of them than by me, and knew of any constitutional way he could be put in my place, he should have it. I would gladly yield it to him. But I do not know that, all things considered, any other person has more of the confidence of the people. And however this may be, there is no way in which I can have any other man put where I am. I am here. I must do the best I can, and bear the responsibility of taking the course which I feel I ought to take." Though these words were spoken in private, their import carried over, with the result that such power as he seized, and it was much, far more, in fact, than any president had ever had before, in peace or war, was surrendered by the people in confidence that the power was not being seized for its own sake, or even for Lincoln's sake, but rather for the sake of preserving the Union. They gave him the power, along with the responsibility, glad to have a strong hand on the reins. This fear of weakness had been the source of their gravest doubt through the opening year of conflict, as well as the subject of the editor's most frequent complaint. Lincoln was lacking in will and purpose. Now they knew that their fears had been misplaced. A Kentucky visitor, turning to leave the White House, asked the president what cheering news he could take home to friends. By way of reply, Lincoln told him a story about a chess expert who had never met his match until he tried his hand against a machine called the automaton chess player, and was beaten 3 times running. Astonished, the defeated expert got up from his chair and walked slowly around and around the machine, examining it minutely as he went. At last he stopped and leveled an accusing finger in its direction. "There's a man in there," he cried. Lincoln paused, then made his point. "Tell my friends there is a man in here." Something else he was as well, a literary craftsman, though so far this had gone unrecognized, unnoticed, and for the most part would remain so, until critics across the Atlantic, unembarrassed by proximity, called attention to the fact. Indeed, complaints had been registered that he wrote like a half-educated lawyer, with little or no appreciation for the cadenced beauties latent in the English language, awaiting the summons of the artist who knew how to call them up. That there was such a thing as the American language, available for literary purposes, had scarcely begun to be suspected by the more genteel, except as it had been employed by writers of low dialogue bits, which mainly served to emphasize its limitations. Lincoln's jog-trot pose, compacted of words and phrases still with the bark on, had no music their ears were attuned to. It crept by them. However, an ambiguity had been sensed. Remarking the twofold working of the twofold nature of the man, one caller at least had observed the contrast between Lincoln the Westerner, slightly humorous but thoroughly practical and sagacious, and Lincoln the President and Statesman, seen in those abstract and serious eyes which seemed withdrawn to an inner sanctuary of thought, sitting in judgment on the scene and feeling its far reach into the future. Here was a clue, but it went uninvestigated. Apparently it was miracle enough that a prairie lawyer had become president without pressing matters further to see that he had also become a stylist. In fact, so natural and unlabored had his utterance seemed that when people were told they had an artist in the White House, their reaction was akin to that of the man in Molière who discovered that all his life he had been speaking prose. "I am here. I must do the best I can," Lincoln had said. And that best included this. Natural, perhaps it was. Unlabored, it was not. Long nights he toiled in his workshop, the inner sanctuary from which he reached out to the future. And here indeed was the best clue of all, for he worked with the dedication of the true artist, who, whatever his sense of superiority in other relationships, preserves his humility in this one. He knew, as a later observer remarked, the dangers that lurk in iotas. There were days when callers, whatever their importance, were turned away with the explanation that the president was at work, which meant writing. A series of such days came in November, and the occasion was the preparation of a message to Congress, which would convene December 1st. Lincoln saw already what would later become obvious, but was by no means obvious yet, that the war had ended one phase and was about to enter another. This message was intended to signal that event, bidding farewell to the old phase and setting a course for the new. Basically, it was dedicatory, for there was need for dedication. The fury of Perryville, the blood that had stained the Antietam and sluiced the ridge in front of Sharpsburg, had re-emphasized the fact disclosed on a smaller scale at first Bull Run and Wilson's Creek, then augmented at Shiloh and the Seven Days, that both armies were capable of inflicting and withstanding terrible wounds. Though it was incredible that the ratio of increase would be maintained, there would be other Shilohs, other Sharpsburgs, other terrors. Men in their thousands now alive would presently be dead. Homes so far untouched by sorrow would know tears. New widows and new orphans, some as yet unmarried or unborn, would be made. All as Lincoln sought that the nation might continue and that men now in bondage might have freedom. In issuing the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, he had made certain that there would be no peace except by conquest. He had weighed the odds and made his choice, foreseeing the South's reaction. "A restitution of the Union has been rendered forever impossible," Davis said. Lincoln had known he would say it. The fact was, he had been saying it all along. What he meant, and what Lincoln knew he meant, was that the issue was one which could only be settled by arms, and that the war was therefore a war for survival. Survival of the South, as Davis saw it, survival of the Union, as Lincoln saw it. With the added paradox that while neither of the two leaders believed victory for his side meant extinction for the other, each insisted that the reverse was true. On the face of it, Davis had rather the better of his opponent in this contention, since the immediate and admitted result of a Southern defeat would be that the South would go out of existence as a nation, however well it might survive in the sense that Lincoln intended to convey. The threat of national extinction was a sharper goad than any the Northern leader could apply in attempting the unification he saw was necessary. Therefore, he determined to try for something other than sharpness. It was here that his particular talent, though so far it had gone unrecognized in general, could most effectively be brought to bear. As he had done against Douglas in the old days, so now in his long-range contest with Davis, he shifted the argument onto a higher plane. Douglas had wanted to talk about popular sovereignty, the right of the people of a region to decide for themselves the laws and customs under which they would live. But Lincoln had made slavery the issue to the little giant's unavoidable discomfort. Similarly, in the present debate, while Davis spoke of self-government, Lincoln, without ever dropping the pretense that Davis was invisible, was in fact not there at all, appealed to the mystic chords of memory and the chorus of the Union, then presently moved on to slavery and freedom, which Davis could no more avoid than Douglas had been able to do. Lincoln tarred them both with the same brush, doing it so effectively in the present case that the tar would never wear off, and managed also to redefine the Davis concept of self-government as destructive of world democracy, which was shown to depend on survival of the Union with the South as part of the whole. In thus discounting the claims of his opponent, he rallied not only his own people behind him, but also those of other lands where freedom was cherished as a possession or a goal, and thus assured non-intervention. Davis, in time, like other men before and since, found what it meant to become involved with an adversary whose various talents included those of a craftsman in the use of words. A case in point was this December message. It was a long one, nearly 50,000 words, and it covered a host of subjects, all of them connected directly or indirectly with the war. "Fellow citizens of the Senate and House of Representatives," it opened, "since your last annual assembling, another year of health and bountiful harvest has passed, and while it has not pleased the Almighty to bless us with a return of peace, we can but press on, guided by the best light he gives us, trusting that in his own good time and wise way all will yet be well. The Civil War, which has so radically changed for the moment the occupations and habits of the American people, has necessarily disturbed the social condition and affected very deeply the prosperity of the nations with which we have carried on a commerce that has been steadily increasing throughout a period of half a century. It has at the same time excited political ambitions and apprehensions which have produced a profound agitation throughout the civilized world. We have attempted no propagandism and acknowledged no revolution, but we have left to every nation the exclusive conduct and management of its own affairs. Our struggle has been, of course, contemplated by foreign nations, with reference less to its own merits than to its supposed and often exaggerated effects and consequences resulting to those nations themselves. Nevertheless, complaint on the part of this government, even if it were just, would certainly be unwise." After this rather mild and dry beginning, he passed at once, or the clerk did, for Lincoln did not deliver the message in person, to matters drier still. A new commercial treaty had been arranged with the Sultan of Turkey, while similar arrangements with Liberia and Haiti were pending. Financially, he was pleased to report the country was quite sound. Treasury receipts for the July through June fiscal year were $583,885,247.06, and disbursements totaling $570,841,700.25 had left a balance of $13,043,546.81 to be carried over. Restlessness among the frontier tribes perhaps indicated that the Indian system needed to be remodeled. The Pacific Railway was being pushed toward completion. A Department of Agriculture had been established. The clerk droned on, advising the squirming congressman that these details will claim your most diligent consideration, though this could hardly have been easy, comprising as they did nearly half of the long document. By now the assembled politicians were nearly as restless as the red men on the frontier. Presently, however, approaching its midpoint, the message changed its tone. "A nation may be said to consist of its territory, its people, and its laws. The territory is the only part which is of certain durability. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. It is of the first importance to duly consider and estimate this ever-enduring part, that portion of the earth's surface which is owned and inhabited by the people of the United States, is well adapted to be the home of one national family, and it is not well adapted for two or more. There is no line, straight or crooked, suitable for a national boundary upon which to divide. Trace through from east to west upon the line between the free and slave country, and we shall find a little more than one-third of its length are rivers, easy to be crossed and populated, or soon to be populated, thickly upon both sides, while nearly all its remaining length are merely surveyors' lines, over which people may walk back and forth without any consciousness of their presence." Such an argument might have been advanced in support of the unification of Europe or the annexation of Canada, but presently the listeners saw what Lincoln was getting at. He was talking to the inhabitants of the region to which he himself was native, the great interior region, bounded east by the Alleghenies, north by the British dominions, west by the Rocky Mountains and south by the line along which the culture of corn and cotton meets. Ascertain from the statistics the small proportion of the region which has as yet been brought into cultivation, and also the large and rapidly increasing amount of its products, and we shall be overwhelmed with the magnitude of the prospect presented. And yet this region has no sea coast, touches no ocean anywhere. As part of the nation, its people now find, and may forever find, their way to Europe by New York, to South America and Africa by New Orleans, and to Asia by San Francisco. These outlets, east, west, and south, are indispensable to the well-being of the people inhabiting and to inhabit this vast interior region. Which of the three may be the best is no proper question. All are better than either, and all of right belong to that people and to their successors forever. True to themselves, they will not ask where a line of separation shall be, but will vow rather that there shall be no such line. After a pause, he added, "Our national strife springs not from our permanent part, not from the land we inhabit, not from our national homestead. Our strife pertains to ourselves, to the passing generations of men, and it can without convulsion be hushed forever with the passing of one generation." This brought him at last to what he considered the nub of the issue. Without slavery, the rebellion could never have existed. Without slavery, it could not continue. So far, he had not mentioned the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation except to note that it had been issued, nor did he return to it now. What he returned to instead was his old plan for compensated emancipation, the one way he saw for bringing the war to an end without convulsion. His plan, as expanded here, would leave to each state the choice of when to act on the matter. Now, or at the end of the century, or at any intermediary time. The federal government was to have no voice in the action, but it would bear the total expense by issuing long-term bonds as payment to loyal masters. To those critics who would complain that the expense was too heavy, Lincoln replied beforehand that it was cheaper to pay in bonds than in blood, as the country was doing now. Besides, even in dollars and cents, the cost would be less. Certainly it is not so easy to pay something as it is to pay nothing, but it is easier to pay a large sum than it is to pay a larger one. And it is easier to pay any sum when we are able than it is to pay it before we are able. The war requires large sums and requires them at once. The aggregate sum necessary for compensated emancipation, of course, would be large. But it would require no ready cash, nor the bonds even, any faster than the emancipation progresses. This might not and probably would not come before the end of the 37 years. At this point, apparently, at any rate somewhere along the line, the president had done some ciphering. By 1900, he predicted, we shall probably have 100 million of people to share the burden instead of 31 million as now. This was no wild guess on Lincoln's part, or as he put it, I do not state this inconsiderately. At the same ratio of increase which we have maintained on an average from our first national census of 1790 until that of 1860, we should in 1900 have a population of 103,208,415. And why may we not continue that ratio far beyond that period? Our abundant room, our broad national homestead, is our ample resource. The past 70 years had shown an average decennial increase of 34.6%. Applying this to the coming 70 years, he calculated the 1930 population at 251,680,914. And we will reach this too, he added, if we do not ourselves relinquish the chance by the folly and evils of disunion, or by long and exhausting war springing from the only great element of national discord among us. Descending from these rather giddy mathematical heights, Lincoln continued his plea for gradual emancipation, not only for the sake of the people here represented, but also for the sake of the Negroes, whom it would spare the vagrant destitution which must largely attend immediate emancipation in localities where their numbers are very great. Whatever objections might be raised, he wanted one thing kept in mind. If there ever could be a proper time for mere catch arguments, that time surely is not now. In times like the present, men should utter nothing for which they would not willingly be responsible through time and in eternity. And having thus admonished the assembly after forcing it to accompany him on an excursion into the field of applied mathematics, he thought perhaps some note of apology, if not of retraction, was in order. I do not forget the gravity which should characterize a paper addressed to the Congress of the Nation by the Chief Magistrate of the Nation. Nor do I forget that some of you are my seniors, nor that many of you have more experience than I in the conduct of public affairs. Yet I trust that in view of the great responsibility resting upon me, you will perceive no want of respect to yourselves in any undue earnestness I may seem to display. Apparently, however, this was intended not only to make amends for what had gone before, but also to brace them for what was to come. Nor was it long in coming. Hard on the heels of this apology for undue earnestness, he threw a cluster of knotty rhetorical questions full in their faces. Is it doubted, then, that the plan I propose, if adopted, would shorten the war and thus lessen its expenditure of money and of blood? Is it doubted that it would restore the national authority and national prosperity and perpetuate both indefinitely? Is it doubted that we here, Congress and Executive, can secure its adoption? Will not the good people respond to a united and earnest appeal from us? Can we, can they, by any other means, so certainly or so speedily assure these vital objects? We can succeed only by concert. It is not, can any of us imagine better, but can we all do better? Object whatsoever is possible, still the question recurs. Can we do better? As the long message approached its end, Lincoln asked that question, can we do better? Oratory was not enough. The North responds sufficiently in breath, he had said of the reaction to the September proclamation, but breath alone kills no rebels. He knew as well as Sherman the need for the nation to be born again, and he would also have agreed with the New England major who this month wrote home that he sometimes felt like changing the old soldier's prayer into, O God, if there be a God, save my country, if my country is worth saving. A majority of 100,000 voters in Lincoln's own state, fearing the backwash of liberated slaves that would result from Grant's advance, had approved in November the adoption of a new article into the Illinois Constitution prohibiting the immigration of Negroes into the state. He knew, too, the reaction of most of the lawmakers to the proposal he was now advancing, including that of Senator Orville Browning, his fellow Illinoisan and confidant, who would write in his diary of his friend's plea when he went home tonight. It surprised me by its singular reticence in regard to the war and some other subjects which I expected discussed, and by the hallucination the President seems to be laboring under that Congress can suppress the rebellion by adopting his plan of compensated emancipation. Yet according to Lincoln it was not he but they who were hallucinated and enthralled, and he told them so as the long message wore on toward a close. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. Then came the end, the turn of a page that opened a new chapter. And now, through the droning voice of the clerk, the Lincoln music sounded in what would someday be known as its full glory. Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We say we are for the Union. The world will not forget that we say this. We know how to save the Union. The world knows we do know how to save it. We, even we here, hold the power and bear the responsibility. In giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free, honorable alike in what we give and what we preserve. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. Other means may succeed. This could not fail. The way is plain, peaceful, generous, just, a way which, if followed, the world will forever applaud, and God must forever bless. This concludes the reading of The Civil War, A Narrative, Volume 1, Fort Sumter to Perryville, by Shelby Foote. Copyright 1958 by Shelby Foote. Copyright renewed 1986 by Shelby Foote. This book was read by Grover Gardner. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Robert Louis Rosen Associates Limited, and was produced in 2016 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.